The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, FA Cup. Liverpool's Man City victory. Zach Steffen with the worst response to the sudden arrival of Mane since those Magpie fans in headdresses. Meanwhile, Chelsea barely breaking sweat with Palace. Insert your Prince Andrew jokes here. And we're all set for the final. We'll be talking about Premier League 2, Burnley's news, Michael Jackson and Me, brackets, not another documentary, as Clarets roll the dice by ending Dyche's role. Our thoughts on that and the midweek action coming up in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Monday 18th of April. Listener, hello to you. Wheels up with another Totally, featuring today Daniel's story. Much travelled, Daniel's story. Hello.
Hi, James.
Hello. Sasha Gurionov is also with us. All right, Sash.
Good morning, James. I'm also much travelled, but unfortunately, I managed to miss all the football, so I had to catch it on the TV.
Well, you're going to love hearing all about it from Daniel. And currently live from Paris, Tom Williams. Tom.
Good morning, James.
Good morning to you. Joyous pack. That's a bomb pack.
That's what bomb they pack. Say.
Yeah.
No All Easter right. egg, sadly, though, at the Parc des Princes last night. I was slightly disappointed.
Right. A lot of people led with the no away fans, but you're right. The bigger story, no giveaway confectionery. Were there Easter eggs at Wembley, Daniel's story, for both the semi-finals, which you turned up to?
There were not, unfortunately. There was plenty of goodies, but not Easter-themed.
Mm.
Actually, yeah. I tell a lie. There was cupcakes yesterday that had cream and two mini eggs on each. So,
ooh, all right. Nice touch.
That's how they buy.
They're always slightly tastier than you think they're going to be, aren't they? Mini eggs.
Yeah.
I always think they're kind of a bit of a nothingy treat. But there's taste there. There's enjoyment to be had.
All right, we're doing this, Sasha. You might as well tell us your favourite Easter Easter treat.
Well, this Easter I was actually in the National Space Center on Saturday during the football. So in a way, I was kind of I was there to see the debunking of the whole Easter myth, if you like.
Is that when Leicester, Sash?
It's a Leicester. Yep, I was on the way back. So okay. I, in my infinite wisdom, I thought that FA in the infinite wisdom would not have FA Cup final weekends on Easter weekend. So I never even bothered checking it's this weekend. So I thought it was going to be next weekend.
Right.
So I planned a trip to Yorkshire and I had a 5-hour drive on Saturday. So I was effectively following the FA Cup semi-final in the National Space Centre, learning about Gagarin, the elements, the solar system and all that as the Liverpool goals flew in.
Tick those off your very obvious bingo card for the intro.
That's, Sasha, I'm wondering where to begin with that. Was it good? Is it good, the National Space Centre?
It's okay. I think it's organisationally, I think for the kids, it's a little bit tough. So I think it requires maybe more than one visit, especially when you're trying to break up a 5-hour car journey. But
right.
I think it was a lovely stop. And, you know, I was there sort of learning about Yuri Gagarin as I got a ping that Konate saw the bar for everyone else to head the first
nice.
One.
Found space.
And
yeah.
Exactly. Found space and, you know, above everybody. And I was there obviously learning about the elements and how the solar system was formed when, you know, Stefan was making elementary mistakes. You know, I could carry on with this,
nice.
But let's actually talk about the football.
Yeah, and also apparently there's a room where they debunk the myth of Christianity, according to Sasha. Well, listen, you might have an issue with that. I don't know. I think it's a broader issue than your approach suggests. Let's talk about the FA Cup, because that sounds simpler. Saturday, Liverpool beating Man City 3-2. Sunday, then, a Chelsea 2-0 winners over Palace to set up another Chelsea-Liverpool Wembley final. Hurrah. Daniel, you went to both. Mm. How gobsmacked were you by that first half on Saturday?
Yeah, I heard Jurgen Klopp say that it's the best, intimating it's the best he'd seen Liverpool play. I actually didn't think that they were brilliant. I thought the City were just absolutely terrible. The third goal was brilliant. There's no doubt about that. It's a wonderful team move. It's an excellent finish. I think Edison maybe would have saved it, but that's, you know, there were bigger mistakes to focus on with Zach Steffen. But Liverpool didn't really create that much in the first half because they didn't really need to. The first goal was a set piece. Konate now has 3-3. He's clearly brilliant at doing that. Kind of that hang time was extraordinary. And the second goal was, you know, was bizarre. But I didn't think Liverpool were brilliant. I just thought City were absolutely terrible. That's as bad. There's something about watching City regularly that when they produce one of these performances, and they do it very, very infrequently, it's almost physically hard to watch because you know what they're trying to do, and yet they just couldn't do any aspect of it.
Was the big thing here then that one team made their seven changes midweek and one team did it on Saturday?
Yeah, I think the Champions League, you know, the second leg of the quarterfinals were clearly hugely instructive. Guardiola said before the game, I had no choice. He repeated that after the game, I didn't have a choice. I think he did have a choice. I don't think he had to play Stefan, although I understand that giving substitute goalkeepers chances is seen as the right thing to do. I think if you're going to pick pretty much a new defence, then you should probably pick your best goalkeeper. I also thought Fernandinho was the key because it makes you realise just how good Rodri is, not just with his passing, but in his kind of his courage in taking the ball with his back to goal, backing himself to resist the pressure that comes. We saw him do that. We've seen him do that time and time again against Liverpool. And I thought these really did feel like the last knockings of Fernandinho. He's kind of half a second late to do everything, to show for the ball, to pass the ball, to dive into challenges. His tactical fouls that he's been really good at, I thought he was lucky not to be sent off because they are becoming more obvious now as he slows down. And I thought that was the big difference. I think if Edison and Rodri had played, they would have got away with the defence. But without those two and with a changed defence, that, yeah, they look terrible. And all credit to Liverpool for kind of seizing upon that. Because if you make seven changes and go 3-0 down, you can't get back in the game. If you make no changes and go 3-0 up, you can effectively kind of stroll through the second half, which is pretty much what Liverpool did.
It felt a bit like Diego Simeone's revenge to me, in the sense that City obviously went into the game off the back of that extremely grueling Champions League game in midweek against Atletico, with where they expended a lot of energy both physically and mentally, you know, with that sort of knife edge scenario right up to the end of the game, and obviously losing Kyle Walker and Kevin De Bruyne, who were two key players, two irreplaceable players, and whereas they were going through that in Madrid at the same time, you know, Liverpool are able to basically send out a reserve team against Benfica and have a bit of a knockabout 3-3 draw that doesn't prevent them from going through. So I think that was certainly a factor. I agree with Daniel. I thought City looked absolutely awful, looked really, really unfocused, really leggy, really tired. And you wonder whether that could become a factor. I think that, you know, that Liverpool do have greater squad depth in certain areas, particularly in the forward line. It's much easier for them to rotate, and they have players who are happy to spend time on the bench, like Roberto Firmino, and come in, you know, when needed, as he did against Benfica. I don't think it's quite as easy for City to rotate. I think when they're missing big players, you notice it more. And I wonder whether that might be something that ends up kind of undermining them as we head into the final weeks of the season.
Right. And Liverpool chased the quadruple. Sasha, you've caught up with the game since your trip to the Space Centre, yeah?
Twice.
Nice, okay. So, should we talk about Efn Zak Stefan and that kind of Karius-esque moment when he tried to do an Edison? In his defence, was the difference partly here the fact that it wasn't Jota chugging his way towards him this time, but Manny arriving at the speed of light?
Well, I mean, obviously Liverpool changed the centre-forwards compared to last week, so yeah, it would have been Mané's job this time. But I still think he took such a long time, and even as the player is coming in towards him, he takes that absolutely unnecessary touch that takes it away from him. So I think from his point of view, yeah, it's just a complete brain fart, and I think he basically froze there and then. But I think what needs to be pointed out here, it didn't just happen. Liverpool actually forced City's possession back from their own half. So City were basically boxed in, and they really had no passing options. So something very, very similar at the Etihad last Sunday, a game I did go to, where Liverpool's passing lanes were completely cut out, the balls with the keeper, and on occasion, Alisson just booted it out, often to a City player in the middle of the park, but it would just get it away. Whereas I think, obviously, Stefan in this situation, he didn't take that decision, but a lot of what I saw in the first half was, in fact, the reverse, I think, of what we saw the Sunday before. And I think quite a few people picked up on that. But one of the reasons that Liverpool, I think, looked so better in the press itself was the presence of Keita, because he is, I think, he a year on from his disaster at against Real Madrid, I think he now feels as finally after all these years as part of that Liverpool midfield. So his pressing is much more dynamic, and also Diaz. I think Diaz compared to Jota, if we look at Jota over the last few months, I would say I think Jota's kind of contribution to the overall Liverpool play can be on and off, whereas Diaz is completely relentless. So I think this is why they're boxing City and they're right on top of City. City have no time, and they freeze on the spot like Stefan did. Also, City don't do their homework, because the first Liverpool goal, we've seen exactly the same goal scored against Benfica the previous, like exactly the same delivery from a corner to that spot. So I know there's three big guys coming in, Van Dijk, Fabinho and Konate, and they're big dudes to defend against, but it's exactly the same spot, it's exactly the same corner. And then, of course, to finish it all off, you know, the goal on the stroke of half-time, and then Liverpool fans are going to, into half-time in absolute delirium. And I was watching those scenes, obviously very, very jealous not to be there. But what a joyous occasion on such sunny Wembley, 3-0 up at half-time against City, who are, you know, your biggest rivals for absolutely everything at the moment.
I think one thing we should say is that, you know, Liverpool play Manchester United on Tuesday night. If they look leggy against... We presume that Klopp will pick pretty much the same team, certainly an incredibly strong team. Manchester United are not very good at the moment, but if Liverpool do look leggy and don't win the game, then everything inevitably flips on its head. And Liverpool fans even will say, well, hang on a minute. Yes, we really wanted to get the FA Cup final and we want this idea of the quadruple, but the league is the big target. So, you know, I wrote my piece after the game. It felt very much like one manager who is perennially concerned about fatigue and another manager who is obsessed by the idea of momentum. And Klopp believes that that momentum will take them on further than any effects of fatigue. And I agree with Tom, they do have a better rotation options at the moment. But if they are leggy against Manchester United, that clearly ebbs, you know, erodes some of the joy out of the FA Cup semi-final defeat.
Right.
I don't think they will be leggy against Manchester United. And I think even if they are a bit leggy, they're probably still too good for Manchester United. So I think Klopp got it right.
United, who they beat 5-0 at Old Trafford earlier this season. This time, of course, that game will be at Anfield. City themselves will only have 24 hours more rest before they take the field against the super hot Seagulls out of Brighton. Can they spring a third straight shock away win? We'll talk about that perhaps a little bit later on. Oh, Luis Diaz. You mentioned Luis Diaz. So Jota came in kind of midway through last season and just slotted straight in, looked fantastic. Luis Diaz, what a signing. And you know, when you talk about City being ersatz and being kind of down to their uppers and that, it does seem extraordinary that Liverpool, who don't have anything like the same spending power, I think it's fair to say, should have that many more options at this point.
I think they brought in replacements, as we're finally seeing, precisely for the positions where they would need to do that rotation, which is, again, from what I understand, you know, the signing of Diaz was somewhat opportunistic. Maybe they were going to wait until the summer, but they had to move. But at the moment, you look at the Liverpool front line, okay, you have Salah, but the other four can be interchangeable. And also, I think you see now the strength in midfield, because now Liverpool don't really have many or even any injuries at the moment. So Keita's finally coming of age, is looking very good. I mean, the Thiago, Fabinho, Keita midfield, I think, played on for only the second time. The first time they played was Benfica away. Liverpool should have been 6-0 up at halftime. So that they're looking superb. And Konate, because the presence of Konate, who has now pushed Gomez further down the pecking order, the presence of Konate allows Liverpool to rotate Matip. And we know that Matip cannot play every 3 days, but Matip's played 36 games this season, and Konate played about 19. Sometimes they play together, but this means, again, from the previous weekend, they have Konate now with a bit more pace to defend against City, and it feels like where there are the replacements and where you can make the three subs, they're certainly not weakening the team at all, and that's what we saw at the Etihad the week before. So I think, yeah, I think on the one hand, yes, I think they're managing the injuries a lot better. In fact, that there aren't any. But on the other, I think you do look at the players and there are replacements precisely where you need them.
Mm-hmm. And there's a contrast with City there again, because, you know, they paid £100 million for Jack Grealish in a position where they probably have their best strength in depth, because pretty much any of those attacking midfielders can at least start in that position and then roam from it. And Fernandinho is no longer a capable deputy to Rodri. That felt like the natural position to upgrade last summer. But Guardiola's been pretty good at that. In kind of, Rodri is clearly the first choice, but he's played as them as a, he's played with a two before. He's played Gundogan there as well. I think both Gundogan and Fernandinho are on the kind of last fumes of their City careers. In fact, it's surprising that Gundogan is still there. So that feels like a blind spot. That feels like a mistake made last summer if they don't go on and win one or both of the league and Champions League.
Also, Guardiola very curiously waiting until the very end of the game to turn to his substitutes bench, which he seems to do often when City is struggling. Actually, he'll sort of, you know, leave it to the players who are out there, as if to say, well, you know, you got yourselves into this mess, it's up to you to get out of it. But there are so many options on that City bench. You could see right from the start of the game that they looked a little bit, you know, a little bit overcooked physically. And yet it wasn't until the 83rd minute that he turns to the bench, sends on Mahrez. And within minutes, Mahrez has set up the goal for Bernardo Silva that gives City that very faint glimmer of hope. You wonder what Mahrez and perhaps some of the other players on the bench might have been able to achieve had they had a slightly better run at it. And I think that's another sort of slightly curious example of Guardiola's squad management, that when things aren't going well, he seems strangely reluctant to try and mix things up with substitutions.
Mm. Yeah, well, the game ending in disappointment for City and starting in disappointment for all concerned, really, with the disruption of the minute silence for the 97 fans who died at Hillsborough. Daniel, how bad was this there at the stadium?
I mean, it was certainly noticeable, and it was noticeable enough that I'm sure the referee ended the period of silence early because it was understandably responded to with boos from Liverpool supporters. It was I'm sure only a few hundred, because you don't need
still
in a period
lot, though.
Yeah, yeah,
you people don't, who
yeah, I agree, and you don't need that many people in a period of silence to sound pretty loud. The good thing is that both Manchester City released a statement immediately apologising to Liverpool, which was predictable. And also, I've seen a lot of City fans on Twitter saying, you know, you are a disgrace to our club. And after this sort of thing, people often say, well, they're not true supporters. They are true supporters. They've gone to a semi-final in a city quite a long way away, and they've bought tickets and they've gone to support their club. They are true supporters, and it's on the club to find them and stop them from going to games again if that's how they're going to behave, because it's just abhorrent, ignorant behaviour.
Mm. Well, for Liverpool, meanwhile, the quadruple is still on. No club has ever reached the League Cup final, the FA Cup final and the Champions League final in the same season. And of course, there's the league as well. Villarreal in the cup, Sasha. In the league, both teams in action midweek, as we mentioned, Man City on Wednesday hosting Brighton, Man United on Tuesday. Sasha, you're going to turn up for this one, local museums permitting.
Yeah, I think I'll make it up to Anfield for the United game. I'm not really... After you play City, you know, at the moment it feels like the next game is almost like you're back to the real life. But... United against Norwich, I mean, Rangnick was very downbeat after that. You know, if you play like that against Liverpool, basically no chance. But there was nothing looking at United, you know, in terms of organisation at the back, the way the midfield was bypassed. I mean, looking at that, there's certainly nothing pointing that they can cause an upset at Anfield. Again, as mentioned earlier, maybe there might be a little bit of fatigue from Liverpool, but I do think they rotated well. I mean, as terrible as it sounds, I expect like sort of quite a routine win without maybe exerting too much, because they have a 5-day break after this until Everton and then 3 days until Villarreal. But I think they will be building up towards Villarreal now, because I can see those games being incredibly energy sapping for Liverpool. I think they're going to have to work stupendously hard to keep up the pace against Villarreal, to break them down, to drag that defensive unit apart. So I think we'll see now that Liverpool, while they need to continue winning in the league, Villarreal is definitely going to be the focus.
And desperate times for Manchester United fans who have long felt that the 1999 treble could never be improved upon. And yet here we are with Liverpool, possibly, what, 10 games? Fewer than 10 games away from...
11.
Bettering it, which seems completely inconceivable, and yet is absolutely is absolutely on the table.
Well, you know, in 1999 Liverpool tried to spanner the treble bid. They drew 2-2 at Anfield in mid-May. I think must have been two or three games left after that, and I think then Arsenal dropped the points to let United in. But I remember that night at Anfield, it was certainly very raucous. It was certainly, yes, we're finally going to spoil United party here. I think Ince scored late on.
Yes, yeah, I remember
but,
it well. Yeah,
but in the end, it was of no use. And I do remember that May 99 with utter horror.
All right, well, we're going to be recalling Sunday at Wembley. Possibly a bit of horror in that one as well, but that's coming up next.
Well, listeners, there's no rest for the wicked at the business end as Liverpool play host to Manchester United this Tuesday evening in the Premier League. Both sides will be all business as Klopp's men are on a mission to make up that point on Man City, whilst United somehow continue in the hunt for a top four finish following last weekend's snakes and ladders results with Spurs and Arsenal. When was the last time United won at Anfield, I hear you ask? Well, the answer is January 17th, 2016. And that was the year, the odd year, that Leicester won the league. In terms of the betting for Tuesday, don't make the traders run because they're full of chocolate after Easter Sunday, but they see no chance of Liverpool's pursuit of City being derailed by Ronaldo and co. Liverpool are the odds-on favourites at 4-11. The draw is 15-4 and United to win the match is 13-2. Now, last time the sides met, Liverpool were 5-0 winners at Old Trafford, and it was no surprise that Ollie's head rolled a few weeks after. Revenge, you would like to think, would be on the cards for the visitors, but Liverpool, who have just lost twice in 25 games in all comps, are taking scalps for fun with Klopp's vast array of attacking talent. Meanwhile, league leaders Man City play host to Brighton on Wednesday, and Pep's men are 2-11 to see off the Seagulls. In terms of the title race, listeners, it's Man City 2-5, Liverpool 15-8. And as far as deep, scratchy, husky voices go in the Premier League, it lost a real gem this week in the form of Sean Dyche. Former Blades boss Chris Wilder is the favourite to be the next Burnley manager. Big Sam is 5-2 and Wayne Rooney 11-2.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Werner again. Mount wants it back again. Got the touch. Mount! For the first time in his career, he scores in three successive games. And it could be the goal that takes Chelsea to a third consecutive FA Cup final.
All right, Chelsea, Crystal Palace, also at Wembley. Also in the FA Cup semi-finals this weekend. Very different feel, particularly to this first half, I'm thinking, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, it was slumber. I think the issue came from it being exactly as we had expected. You know, Vieira has tried to oversee this kind of possession revolution at Palace, but in recent weeks, and particularly against the bigger clubs, he's been prepared to be pragmatic and sit deep. He changed formation to go with this five at the back. I suspect because that's what Brentford was so successful with doing against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, and tried to hit them on the counter. And they do have some wonderful counter-attacking players. The issue was that they just didn't link on the counter. The ball didn't stick with Jean-Philippe Mateta. Zaha was dealt with, I thought, brilliantly by Reece James, who played as a slightly surprisingly as the right-sided centre-back with Azpilicueta as the wing-back. I think because of that recovery pace in behind that Rudiger doesn't necessarily have. And Chelsea just completely shut Palace down. And then it really became a matter of time of when Chelsea would create a good enough chance to score. And I was really pleased for Ruben Loftus-Cheek. It seems remarkable that he started England's last World Cup match in 2018 against Belgium, because he's had a pretty horrible journey since then, including a serious injury. And this was only his second goal since, I think, May 2019, which is remarkable. But Mason Mount was talking about him after the game and saying, you know, he's 26 years old, but he's sort of 23 in terms of football development. And he's still got so much to give. And when he plays well, he just controls that midfield. I thought he was excellent against Real Madrid in midweek, and I thought he was good again here.
Oh, that's good. Loftus-Cheek making that long return from Achilles surgery. Mount, who's making a similar recovery from a haircut. The two scorers of the goals here as Thomas Tuchel makes his way to his sixth major final with Chelsea. Chelsea-Liverpool again. Two draws in the league. A 0-0 and penalties in the League Cup final. Well, a very exciting 0-0 with penalties in the League Cup final, it must be said. Sashi, looking forward to this?
Yeah, tremendously. I think if you look at the three games, that the three draws that Liverpool and Chelsea have had so far, Chelsea perhaps shaded. And Liverpool certainly have struggled through all of those games, and arguably maybe in the league that's what's costing them at the moment, because they didn't beat Chelsea, what a City has. So I thought as far as 0-0 goes, the League Cup final was probably the best 0-0 I've seen. And then obviously the longest penalty shootout I've seen after that. And I think, you know, as far as cup finals go, even though it is a repeat, Liverpool playing City and then Chelsea in the FA Cup kind of feels apt, given that these are easily the three best teams in the country at the moment. So I think to win anything, you basically have to get past those. But I think, looking at Chelsea at the moment, one thing that I think everyone else needs to be worried about from Chelsea's point of view is Werner. I thought sharpness is coming back. I thought he scored a great goal against, I mean, it was 6-0 against Southampton, but there was a very long run that he made with Bednarek all over him, go around the keeper to put it away. His movement is very good between the lines. The way they kind of rotated to set up one of the goals at, to score his goal at Real Madrid. This game here as well, I think, so his overall link-up, I think he sort of maybe finally understands where his place is. And also this is, I think, looking at the way Mount, Havertz and Werner interact with each other, I mean, this has to be the end of Lukaku.
Well, very possibly. Both goals coming from homegrown players, with Timo Werner earning plaudits from many observers, which is another nice thing for Chelsea. Any other points on this game?
Why did Olise not start, Daniel? What did people say?
I think he wanted Mateta to be, if he was going to play this 5-3-2, I think Zaha was certain to start, Eze was certain to start, and I think he wanted, his two options were either to go for the full counter-attacking fly and play with almost three attacking midfielders rather than the central striker. But I think he wanted Mateta to, I guess, to try and take up some of Antonio Rudiger's time and kind of be looked after by Rudiger. But as I say, he was taken off after 54 minutes and the ball just didn't stick. And he brought on Jordan Ayew for that over Christian Benteke, which I guess was probably a return to the plan B, which is of those kind of more diminutive strikers or attacking players. But neither of them really worked. They just didn't. Palace always have a problem in that their wing-backs are more defensive players than attacking wing-backs. You know, they're a world away from Robertson and Alexander-Arnold in terms of intended style. And that means that things have to go through the middle. And they just, you know, in Kouyaté, and they just don't really have creative central midfielders. It goes without saying that they massively lack Conor Gallagher, I think, for that. I don't think he would have been the difference maker, but it's a huge shame that the rules dictate that he can't play in that game, because he offers so much to Palace in terms of that central midfield creativity, and he gives those wide players extra breathing room to find space. And without that, they just looked a bit sluggish.
Worth noting, of course, that this will be the first time the FA Cup final has been an exact replica of the League Cup final in terms of the teams contesting it since 92-93. When Arsenal and Sheffield Wednesday fought out both matches and Arsenal came out on top both times, which to me feels like it happened not all that long ago, but which is basically 30 years ago. So there's a...
Well, in geological time.
For all of us.
In geological terms.
Well, in space time, James. It's
space time.
The blink of an eye.
Yeah. Also, first time that Patrick Vieira has lost in an FA Cup game since, what, 2004? All right. Next up, let's talk about the Premier League.
It's the Paddy Power Football Supporter Support Line, and we're talking to Man United fan Carl.
Yeah, and I'm worried about the trip to Liverpool.
It's the game I'd be worried about, Carl, not the trip.
Yeah, at least the M62 won't be one-way traffic.
It's not always rewarding being a Man United fan, but if you want rewards, you can get a free bet if one leg of your bet builder on Liverpool v Man United lets you down. Paddy Power.
Pre-match online bet builder bets only. Min 2 plus legs. Max one free £5 bet per customer. Must have previously deposited to avail. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18+ BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. And that's good news for Watford fans as they get ready to appoint their fourth manager of the season. Pre-match bet builders only. Get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Premier League, everybody. FA Cup results this weekend mean that 5th and 6th in the Premier League will qualify for the Europa League. 7th gets a slot in the cherished Europa Conference League. Currently in 7th place are West Ham after their 1-1 draw with Burnley above them. Well, the top four race took a twist this weekend. Spurs and Arsenal both losing. And Man United winning against bottom of the table Norwich to move back into the 4th place picture. Those three teams, Spurs, Man United and Arsenal, separated by only 3 points. We'll talk about the top four race, I'm using air quotes there, shortly. But first, down the other end, and Burnley's clash with West Ham. And before that even, the shock news at the end of last week from Turf Moor. I don't know, where were you when you found out? I got a message from producer Charlie saying, Burnley fired Dyche and they've given it to me. I thought, no safer pair of hands. But of course, lols.
It was genuinely surprising. It's the first time I can't remember the last time a managerial sacking was announced and the initial reaction wasn't, oh, well, you could kind of see that coming. Mm. I mean, it would have perhaps been envisageable at the end of the season, you know, if Burnley's relegation had been confirmed by then. But, yeah, to sack Sean Dyche, you know, Mr. Burnley now, when they're still in with a fighting chance of survival, felt extraordinary and elicited a great deal of sympathy. I mean, you know, he's obviously done an incredible job at Turf Moor. And even, you know, after the takeover, when people thought that there might be a little bit of money to spend, he hasn't had any money to spend. And albeit Burnley are struggling a lot more this season than they have in previous seasons, they're still in with a fighting chance of escaping relegation. So, yeah, very, very strange decision.
Although this is actually traditionally the favourite time to fire a manager because he had just lost to Norwich in the previous game. Norwich have only won 5 matches this season, and in 3 of those occasions, the team they've beaten have then fired the manager within a week. Tarek Panja writing, "This feels like the start of a death spiral for a club that was in relatively good shape until it was handed over to ALK, who appear to have done nothing beyond using the club's own money to finance their takeover. Now no Dyche and a pile of debt that didn't exist before, fit and proper." Oof.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we don't really even need to read between the lines to work out what Tarek's saying there, and I agree with it. I accept that Dyche has underperformed in the last probably 18 months, but you can't separate that from the fact that keeping Burnley in the league for so long and even getting them into 7th one season was I think the greatest Premier League achievement of the last 10 years apart from Leicester winning the league, basically, because they don't have much money to spend. They're not a fashionable club. When they do spend money, it's because they've just sold a player for more than they're spending. And even in those final weeks of Dyche's reign, you look at Maxwell Cornet's miss against Norwich, which would make it 2-2. Cornet again misses a penalty here. I know Dyche has gone by that point, but yeah, the only explanation I can think of is that it became clear to either the owners or Dyche that he wasn't going to be there next season, and the loss to Norwich made them think, well, if he's not going to be here next season, why not take a gamble now and also potentially have a pick of managers now, go through a full process of appointing them while Ben Mee and Mike Jackson are in temporary charge and get the man we think we want. But it doesn't suggest that they had a kind of succession plan in place. Otherwise, I think that announcement would have come very quickly. If it was someone, let's say, like Sam Allardyce, I think he would have probably been already there by Friday. So then you start looking around for names and managers think, well, I don't know what division you're going to be in next season, so I'm not too sure about taking the job. And it can get messy very quickly. The other particularly important thing to say about Sean Dyche is that there now exists, with the pressure in the being a Premier League manager, this kind of honeymoon when after you've left a job and when you've taken it. And on Sunday night, Dyche was photographed smiling with revelers in Rock City in Nottingham, which is a kind of indie music venue in Nottingham, looking like, I mean, instantly looking sort of 8-10 years younger than he did on the touchline a week before. He looked in a sort of very smart, in kind of emo black polo shirt, but all smiles, queuing to get into Rock City.
can a polo shirt ever be emo?
Yeah, emo's the wrong word. I don't know. It's a sort of, yeah, an indie, maybe in like an indie, sort of vaguely like Arctic Monkeys style,
more of like a mod right. thing. I think.
Yeah.
I think Sean Dyche has got more of a mod tip going on. But I mean, yeah, I think you can make a polo shirt emo as long as you kind of accessorize it with a sleeve tattoo, one of those kind of weird earring things that tears a massive hole in your earlobe, and like, you know, kind of swept over hair.
I think I can confirm Dyche had none of those three.
Yet.
Not yet, at any rate.
Dyche was the Premier League's longest serving manager. As Tom says, there is still a chance of them staying up. They did get a point away at West Ham. How close, though, did they come to starting with a win, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I worry for Burnley that squandered Maxwell Cornet penalty might come back to haunt them, because they were really under the cosh to begin with. I think they would have looked at this and you know, prior to the game, and thought there was a decent chance of them getting a result, given that West Ham were going into the game off the back of that win away at Lyon in the Europa League on Thursday. You know, would they be a little bit knackered? Would there be a bit of a crash? And actually, West Ham were on top, and then they lose Ashley Westwood with that absolutely horrible injury, but managed to take the lead a few minutes later through Wout Weghorst, who back on the score sheet for the first time in a little while. And then Maxwell Cornet wins the penalty. They've got an opportunity to put a daylight between themselves and West Ham. Jay Rodriguez marches towards the penalty area with the ball in his hands, and Cornet wrenches it off him, obviously not the designated penalty taker, puts it wide, and then with a certain degree of inevitability, West Ham end up equalising and could well have won it. And I think had it not been for Nick Pope pulling off a couple of really smart saves at the end, Burnley would have ended up losing. You sort of wonder what would have happened if they'd got that second goal, if that penalty had gone in, they'd been able to go in 2-0 up at half time. Could have been a really, really big win for them. And instead, you know, they end up dropping those 2 points, and still that little bit of daylight between themselves and Everton as a consequence.
But realistically, I mean, how many, also like in terms of the managerial change, how many games do they need to win to stay up? Is it three? Is it like 3.5? Because, I mean, there's 3 points between them and Everton. How many games are Everton going to win before the end of the season? If, like, best case scenario for Burnley, maybe two. So sacking the manager now, they were looking, maybe you've got 8 games, we need to win 3, maybe pick up a couple of draws. Maybe that could be part of the thinking process. Of course, then you look at who is actually in charge on Saturday, on Sunday, maybe there isn't much of a thinking process. But again, like a game like West Ham, I don't think it changes too much in terms of the game, whether Burnley have 1-0 or 2-0 up, because they're basically under the cosh for the rest of the game. And maybe, you know, the floodgates would have burst eventually, because you could see how much pressure they were coming under. They couldn't really break out. The question is, though, they were coming up against a team of Thursday, like that's coming off a very heavy game of Thursday night that really hardly rotated. I think where they've changed maybe a couple of players, maybe three players. West Ham changed from Thursday night, and yet it was Burnley very much looking really, really knackered towards the end of that game, which kind of raises the questions of maybe physically that they're gone at this stage. Maybe they can't actually get those 3 wins because they're completely spent.
Possibly so. They are in action Thursday night against Southampton at home. Everton, who are 3 points above them now, but with a game in hand on the Clarets, will be hosting Leicester on Wednesday. So there's still plenty of life, I reckon, left in that whole relegation battle. But no question, wasting their first penalty of the season didn't help their cause much. West Ham, by the way, victorious away at Lyon in fine fashion, have now got Eintracht Frankfurt, who put out Barcelona from the Europa League.
Oh, talking of Eintracht Frankfurt have all the eggs very much in the Europa League basket now. They lost 2-0 to Union Berlin on Sunday, looking knackered from the Thursday night exploits. This is their only chance of Europe. So I think West Ham have two very, very heavy games coming up there. I know this is probably for the Europod, but everything about their win in Barcelona was just incredible. I think, you know, the 30,000 fans in the ground, you know, prompting, you know, I think a lot of investigation, I think, now on Barcelona side as to how this could happen. I mean, Kostic gets the third goal. He runs towards the corner flag, and all you can see is like is all white in that corner. It's like a home game. After the final whistle, the whole it's a home match. It's absolutely extraordinary. But for me, the moment, I think perhaps of the whole week, is Rafa Boré picking up the ball in the Barcelona half, advancing 25 yards, absolutely smashes it past Ter Stegen.
Ter Stegen!
the way he wraps his foot around it and just flies in. I mean, Rafa Boré, of course, he's the River Plate hero of the Libertadores exploits, hasn't had possibly the greatest of season in Europe. And also afterwards, you know, as they're all celebrating, he's keeping himself... You see he's waiting to do something. He's pointing at number 19. And of course, Boré is Colombian and it's for Freddy Rincon. And I thought that was a very, very moving moment. And just the whole thing. And, you know, whenever Eintracht kind of play in Europe, and you remember they reached the semis a couple of years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago, there's a lot of, it seems to be, they bring a lot of passion into the competition. And for me, like this West Ham Eintracht side now, it's incredibly, incredibly exciting. And I think certainly for both clubs, it's now away from the league. And I think the focus is on that.
Mm, absolutely. What a night that was. On Thursday, we'll be discussing that and loads more in the Euro show, which will be with you kind of from midnight on Monday. And yeah, terrible news about former, well, Napoli, Colombia, lots of other clubs as well, I should probably mention. I think of him as, with the Napoli jersey. I once went to his house in Naples. He's a lovely man, Freddy Rincon. Anyway, died in a car crash last week. Terrible news. Returning to the bottom of the Premier League table then, Burnley still with some slim chances of staying up. Is that it for Watford, though, after their late defeat to Brentford?
Yeah.
Watford equaling the record for most home games lost in succession. That's now 10, joint with Birmingham City from the mid-80s. That's it then, Daniel, is it?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, they are diabolical at home. They have 7 home points this season, which is embarrassing. Their fans are officially very unhappy now. I think while Watford were going up and down at, you know, yo-yoing and pushing to stay up, I think that the supporters understood the model of regularly changing managers and, you know, the kind of the system and the ethos and the culture of the club overriding whoever was in the dugout. But this season they feel that the managerial merry-go-round has continued to turn, and yet there isn't any culture at the club at the moment. The appointment of Claudio Ranieri was a gamble, but I understood why they did it. To then go for basically the same profile of manager as a replacement when that hadn't worked seemed extraordinary. And they didn't buy enough good defenders last summer, and they have been punished. There's this sense, I think, with Watford, and I think it applies to Norwich as well, that because they've there's a kind of inevitability that they're always going to go down. I think if you look at how badly they've played over long periods of the season and the gap, you know, the fact is that they're not mathematically down yet. I think the opposite is true. I think they had a real chance this season that won't exist in other seasons to punish the likes of Everton and Leeds and you know, in the first half of the season, Newcastle as well. And they just didn't do that. They've been there the whole way through because they're just... Yeah, they're just shambolic at the back, and it's a real shame because, you know, as a fan of a Championship club, it's nice to see new clubs in the Championship. As a fan of watching Premier League football, it's nice to have promoted clubs stay up, and I think Brentford have been brilliant by that regard. But yeah, they're just terrible. I mean, 10 home defeats on the bounce is a humiliation, really.
No team in English League football has taken fewer points at home than the Hornets this season.
And yet they should have won it. 90th minute, the ball pops out to Imran Loser, 6 yards out, open goal to aim at. The commentator even thought it was in on Match of the Day, at least.
Couple of ricochets, in goes Sissoko, and against the post, and in by Lowe, he's put it wide. Somehow, Imran Loser has missed.
And then 5 minutes later, Brentford go down the other end and get the winner. And yeah, I guess, you know, sort of... A sign of the kind of form that Brentford are in, that they're able to kind of, you know, get away with close shaves like that, and things are falling for them, and the ball's going into the back of the net. And obviously for Watford, it very much is not.
It's not. 5 wins in the last 6 for Brentford. The only match in that run they didn't win was the one that Christian Eriksen was out for with the COVID.
I mean, transformative signings mid-season, James. Eriksen. Like, this, I mean, people even talk about Diaz now and stuff, but Eriksen, 5 wins out of 5 when he starts. I mean, he's only inverted commas, 1 goal and 2 assists, but a lot of pre-assist passes, a lot of stuff like, I think the chance that Tony missed second half against Watford was just quick thinking, perfect for the whole Brentford reliance on set pieces, of course, because now they can basically, someone who can put it on who can deliver it on the plate. And I think it's just extraordinary the way this has worked out. And yeah, Thomas Frank said after the game that they weren't the best, but you know they still won, and you know this is great. But curiously, this is the second time Brentford beat Watford 2-1 this season with a goal deep into injury time. I think it was 96th minute winner in West London earlier in the season. But I think overall, it's like from my point of view, it's very nice that Eriksen comes in and has such a huge impact, and now Brentford just kind of ease themselves into the end of the season and can also start thinking about next season, whether they can keep Eriksen or signing other signings they need to make. But it's also curious how, from Brentford's point of view, they had obviously kind of hit a bit of a wall and they needed that creative player in the middle of the park, and then they found him, and it's how perfectly it now all fitted in.
Mm. There you go. And they say you can't sign anyone in January. They. Top four race is next on the Totally Football Show.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Scottish Cup semi-finals this weekend for the first time ever consisted of an Edinburgh derby and a Glasgow derby. And it was Hearts and Rangers that made their way through those fixtures. They'll be meeting now on the 21st of May. 2-1 win for Giovanni Van Bronckhorst's Rangers over Celtic at Hampden. In extra time, Totally Football Show Live is coming up. Oh, that's quite soon, actually. 10th of May, we're going to be at the Glee Club in Birmingham. Glee.co.uk is where you can get those one or two tickets that might be left at the back of a drawer somewhere. Totally Football League show is out on Tuesday this week, so a day later than usual, because there's a big Football League programme on Easter Monday. Matt Davis-Adams all over that. And the Athletic Women's Football Podcast is also out on Tuesday. And that, of course, will be devoting a lot of time to the FA Cup semi-finals. Man City will be taking on Chelsea May the 15th in the Women's FA Cup final. Interestingly, either Man City or Chelsea have played in each of the last eight FA Cup finals, although never against each other. So that'll be something new. Also out on Tuesday, as mentioned earlier, the Totally Football Show Euro Edition. We'll get Jules' thoughts on... there's lots in there. We'll get Alvaro on Barcelona, the billion euro takeover of Milan, all sorts of things. And, of course, Le Classique. Tom, what should I ask Jules about that? Was it not that exciting for you?
I mean, you had everything. You had all the ingredients. A beautiful spring evening in one of the world's most beautiful cities. PSG in first place up against second place Marseille. They're great rivals. Marseille trying to delay PSG's procession towards the title. You've got some of the best footballers in the history of the game on the pitch. And it just felt so hollow. So flat, because the PSG fans were officially on strike, so they weren't singing, they weren't cheering. They were still swearing at Marseille players, which was reassuring in itself, but that was the extent of it. The Marseille fans weren't allowed at the game because it's such a sensitive fixture, as has been the case for the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And, you know, PSG won 2-1, but it just felt like a total, total non-event. And I think of all the... Of all the recent disappointments that that PSG have had to suffer, for a game that should be such a kind of festival to feel quite so meaningless was really quite the achievement, I would say.
Yeah, shiny looking confection that ultimately proved hollow. Not many of those around this weekend. Let's talk about the top four race in the Premier League then, which is full of drama. full of passion. Arsenal beaten at Saints. Spurs at home to Brighton, losing. Man United defeating bottom of the table Norwich. Which was the biggest surprise for you?
I mean, Spurs has to be the biggest surprise on the basis they'd scored hatfuls in their recent games. And yet, in retrospect and with the benefit of hindsight, Graham Potter did a number on Spurs and probably, I think, set a blueprint for how teams will try and negate this front three, particularly when the first choice wing backs aren't there. And it seems an extraordinary thing to say about Tottenham. But Matt Doherty, I think, has probably suddenly become a very, very important player for them, because Emerson Royale was not able to get down the wing as well as Conte would have liked, nor was Reggie on the other side. And that shuttled everything to the middle, and Brighton dealt with it brilliantly. Yves Bissouma was fantastic at looking after Harry Kane, not just following him everywhere, but kind of learning when to drop off and give some help to those behind him. They also sat really, really deep, which has to be the way to play against Spurs' front three now, because it just negates all the space in behind them. And they didn't, crucially, and probably the most crucial part of this, I think, is that they didn't not bother to attack. They didn't just go for a 0-0. They didn't try and sit on nothing. They actually tried to push forward and gave Tottenham something to think about. And, you know, recent Spurs games, they've blown away Villa in the second half and they've blown away Newcastle in the second half, but they have started slowly. And Brighton were able to, you know, to repeat that feat and then continue that into the second half by staying deep and not, you know, they push forward without leaving themselves exposed. And all credit to Graham Potter for that. But it is slightly worrying, I suppose, from a Spurs perspective, in that results can happen like this seemingly out of nowhere. But then again, nobody else in the same race is particularly good at the moment anyway, so maybe it won't matter.
All right. Well, indeed, Arsenal losing just last weekend. Spurs' top four rivals, the Gunners, to Brighton, who've now had back-to-back away wins after seven games without a victory. They are on course for their best ever Premier League finish. It's their first win away to Tottenham since 1981. It's Man City next. They couldn't, could they, Tom?
I mean, I thought one thing Brighton did as well as all the things Daniel's just mentioned is they cut off the supply chain to Harry Kane really well, played without a centre-forwards, basically had five midfielders, and just totally swamped Spurs in midfield. And, you know, we know that is such a feature, the way Spurs play. Ball into Kane's feet, he drops deep, spins, and then can, you know, put a pass onto Son's toes or Kulusevski's toes from almost anywhere. And he had very, very few opportunities to do that. And yeah, you know, that was sort of part of the master plan. And I suspect we might see a similar thing against Manchester City, because if you want to stop Manchester City playing, you have to dominate that area of the pitch. So it could well be that performance at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium serves as a blueprint against City as well. Although, you know, you would have thought that given City's need for points, you know, they'll obviously be favourites for that.
Kevin De Bruyne might be back for that game. He was on the bench, an unused sub, on Saturday. City have won 9 of their last 10 meetings with the Seagulls in all competitions. Sasha?
But I think, like, last two games should give Brighton a lot of confidence, because, first of all, I think very obviously the finishing has been very sharp. And I thought Trossard took his goal particularly well in this game as well. But one thing that struck me when I went to watch Brighton-Liverpool back in March was how niggly Brighton is. They're not very nice to play against at all. Especially Cucurella. He's just like, he's just a horror. And I mean, when he started picking on Kulusevski, no wonder Kulusevski was beginning to lose his rag, because he's just all over you. Just this menace running around. So I think, you know, if City are a little bit fatigued, you know, if, you know, Brighton do get under the skin a bit, I think that they have a potential to actually quite majorly disrupt them. Especially now that they have confidence of, you know, these two good wins in North London. And I think overall, Brighton, as we always talk about, they play the good football. But I think there's now a little bit more grit, a little bit more dirt to them. And given the shape that they had against Spurs, could they employ this against City sitting deep and really swamping that midfield? Maybe, but I certainly think that City could be in for a tough game there.
Daniel, you're chortling through that. You're not.
Yeah,
this.
I think Sasha's absolutely right. Cucurella made me laugh on Saturday, because the one incident that he really could have made the most of, and I think Kulusevski was pretty lucky not to have been sent off, he didn't. He just kind of got straight back up, and yet it was almost if for the rest of the game, Brighton were like, well, we gave you that one, so we're now going to make the most of everything and we're going to delay the game. And, you know, these are pushing the boundaries of what is legal. And you know, Spurs fans, I'm sure, will say, well, it shouldn't have been allowed to happen. But you need to do this sort of thing if you're not an elite club. Sasha's absolutely right. Brighton for too long have been a really nice club that play wonderful football and are very popular with neutrals for exactly that reason. But there's no reason why you can't combine the two and help it to make you a better team.
Brilliant. Well, City with a terrific record against the Seagulls. However, Spurs had been on a brilliant run of form coming into this game, as Daniel mentioned, but the Seagulls are denying them even a single shot on target in this game.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I look back at the last time Brighton had played away from home and failed to concede a shot on target, and it was actually at Anfield in February 2021, and Liverpool were on a bit of a sticky run at that point. But I think it's almost as if Brighton have played at two extremes. They either completely shut down teams or they want to really express themselves. And I think the next test for Potter is to try and find the... I think the reason they go on these bad runs is they almost get a little bit excited and carried away. And they're like, right, we're playing well now. We're going to go and pass teams off the park. And they get a bit unstuck. So I think that's why they lurch from good form to bad form, because they go back to the basics and really make it work.
Well, even when it's bad, it's not been bad enough to spoil what, as I say, is set to be their best ever finish in the Premier League, or in the top flight at all, I think, of English football.
And that's despite being the third lowest scorers in the entire division, Brighton. They've only scored 29 goals in 32 games to date, and the only teams to have scored fewer are Burnley with 26 and Norwich with 22.
Crikey. In a big weekend for South Coast Big Smoke clashes, meanwhile, Saints bounce back from there. 6-0 drubbing at the hands of Chelsea with a 1-0 win over Arsenal, who have now lost back-to-back games against coastal outfits. It's Southampton's first league victory since February. That's quite a run, isn't it? Jan Bednarek with the goal. Oh, Daniel. There you were, believing in Arsenal again.
Yeah. Told you. Well, I did caveat it by saying I will undoubtedly be let down by them, as is traditional, and I have been. The injuries have made a difference with Tierney and Partey, and we talked about it last week, but, you know, Lacazette is not performing. He wasn't in the squad at the weekend, I guess, because of a niggle rather than selection issues, but Nketiah is not good enough to lead the line. They don't take enough of their chances.
Two goals from their last 73 attempts.
Yeah, beyond that, I think there is a really dispiriting lack of attitude in that team still, because supporters demanded more before the Brighton game, after they'd lost the previous one against Palace, and they didn't come. They doubly demanded it here because Spurs had already lost. Top four was on the line. They'd lost the last two games. So the one thing we expected them to do was be really upbeat. They were pretty unfortunate not to take a point. Forster was excellent in goal, but It feels like every Arsenal game is played in this kind of isolation where they have no concept of what's at stake and how energetic they need to be and what a tone they need to set. It's galling because it makes people like me look stupid repeatedly.
But I mean, this is what you get with a very young team, isn't it? You know, a team with such a young average age is much more susceptible to being blown off course than a team with more seasoned campaigners. And I think, you know, you look at what's happened to Arsenal. They were absolutely flying right up until the moment they went to Selhurst Park and lost 3-0. And you just feel like almost all the confidence has flown out of the team. And I think particularly when you do have a very young team, that sort of momentum is necessarily a much less stable thing. And, you know, from looking like they were, if not dead certs, then clear favourites for top four, looking at their previous run of form, you now sort of find yourself wondering how quickly they can stop the rot. And are they going to end up just, you know, sinking like a stone?
Well, they are 3 points behind Spurs, but with a game in hand. Do you know where their next match is? It comes Wednesday night. Go on, Sash, you do, don't you?
Chelsea.
Yes. One of four fixtures that the Gunners have in their remaining seven that'll come away from home, which is a bit of a worry. Those matches being Chelsea on Wednesday, West Ham, Spurs and Newcastle. Yikes.
And they've got Manchester United in between as the home game. So it's sort of... after a poor losing streak, it's sort of each of their historic psychological barriers that they have to jump across, and with Chelsea and with Manchester United and then the North London Derby. Basically, they've now given themselves no choice but to prove over again that they are better than they used to be, because if they fall at even two of those four hurdles in the next four games, I think Spurs will probably still have enough.
Can I stun you with a statistic?
Do it.
Please.
Mikel Arteta is unbeaten in his two previous visits to Stamford Bridge as Arsenal manager.
Two. I mean, it sort of feels slightly damning with faint praise that it's only two.
As many as two, James.
As many as two.
Yeah, that's. I mean, that's more than one, isn't
Let
it?
Let me pick my right. jaw off the floor.
Right, there you go. All right, Man United, Daniel, who rank among Arsenal's opponents between now and the end of the season, and who are now level with them in the Premier League table, courtesy of three big points picked up against mighty Norwich at the weekend. Three big points earned by three big goals from Cristiano Ronaldo. It's the 50th hat-trick of his club career. Sorry, Daniel.
Sorry, I was just going to say that there's literally just some quotes landed from Lacazette saying he wants to play in the Champions League and I'm happy to join other clubs, which...
Oh,
great quite... timing.
Oh, Give sorry, just... I should have said that that was on our show last night. I should have mentioned
Tom.
That.
Tom.
You say sorry.
Tom, what show is that?
Canal Football Club, James. That's the show that I do in Paris every weekend. And we had an interview with Alexandre Lacazette and he was asked about how things have been going of late and how he sees things looking next season. And he was talking about the sort of club that he might potentially be tempted to join. And he was asked whether he might be interested in going back to Lyon, being obviously a former Lyon player. And he made it clear that for him, Champions League football is a biggie. And at the very, very least, European football. So a bit of a clue there as to where he sees his immediate future.
If only there was some way of him impacting whether his current club would be in the Champions League next season, that sort of finishing chances or something like that. It's hard.
Mm, hear what you're saying. Any other revelations we should know about from Canal Foot Club?
Canal Football Club. No revelations, I wouldn't say. I mean, great, okay. lots of great chat, lots of laughs, right. as ever. But but yeah, I think that was it on the revelations front.
What were they most interested in? You were there to explain what had happened in English football. What were they most excited or interested by?
So we did what felt like a slightly cruel segment on Harry Maguire's performance against Norwich, which involved kicking Paul Pogba, his own teammate, in the side of the head at a Man United corner, which Pogba was absolutely furious about. And then, in a way that felt quite telling, towards the end of the game, racing back to create an angle for a pass from David De Gea, only to see David De Gea turn and just roll the ball out of play on the opposite side of the pitch, which kind of suggested that it's preferable to concede throw-ins halfway up your own half than it is to even contemplate passing the ball to Harry Maguire. So that was, Crikey. that went down quite well.
All right. Well, I mean, that brings us very nicely back onto Man United, Norwich. United's second win in the last 2 months. Both of those victories coming 3-2 with Cristiano Ronaldo hat-tricks. Have that, haters.
Yeah, I thought the most instructive and interesting part of the game was the reaction to Paul Pogba. I mean, that relationship has been breaking for a while. I don't know if it was because some of the fans were a kind of energised by the pre-match protests and decided, right, well, this is the day where we get everything off our chest. But yeah, it was pretty vitriolic towards Pogba, who kind of cupped his ear as if to say, you know, I can hear you, you know, it's not that helpful. I mean, Pogba probably hasn't helped himself by making it, you know, at least intimating that he probably won't be there next season. But yeah, Manchester United do not need any extra help to make the atmosphere toxic at Old Trafford at the moment. And that felt like another kind of step towards the abyss.
Kind of felt like the point of no return a bit for Pogba, I think, in that there has been a lot of dissent towards him from within United's fan base, because obviously he returned to the club for that huge price tag, big expectations, and has unfortunately for him, I think, become a symbol of this very underwhelming period in United's post-Ferguson history, whilst at the same time doing fantastic things for France, winning the World Cup and looking every inch the superstar footballer that he is, you know, when he's playing in a successful team and has the right sort of structure around him to play the sort of football that he wants to play. But we'd not seen him being booed, being jeered by his own fans before. And it, you know, it's an open secret that he is likely to leave at the end of the season. And I think for me that the sight of him being booed off, having not actually, you know, played badly or really done anything wrong, you know, being booed off just because he's Paul Pogba and he hasn't quite lived up to expectations, that felt like a break. That felt like the end of something.
Mm. All right, next two games for United are at Anfield and then the Emirates. So an absolutely crucial week for them as they await to define their future, whether it's Champions League and also off the field, who's actually going to be in charge. Another of the subjects we'll be discussing in Tuesday's Euro Football Pod, we've got Mikael Jongsma joining us from the Netherlands with the latest.
I should point out that Ajax lost the Dutch Cup final to PSV at the weekend. To kind of, it's almost now as you don't even have to join Manchester United for everything to sort of fall apart. It's enough to be very strongly linked.
They have a 4-point lead in the league. I think they'd have 5 games not to blow it.
Mm. Ooh, speaking of PSV, Leicester went and beat them last Thursday to earn their place in the Europa Conference League semi-finals. Who they're going to be taking on the week after this one? Ooh, Roma. That's exciting. Meantime, Leicester beaten 2-1 away at Newcastle in the other game this weekend in the Premier League. Leicester taking the lead through Ademola Lookman, scoring for his third league start in a row. But then Bruno Guimaraes happened all over them once again. Nice words from Brendan Rodgers afterwards, when he spoke about how happy he was for the Newcastle fans to see them so, well, happy themselves and celebrating. And that Newcastle now a formidable, formidable place to go. What's that? 5 home wins in a row. Both these teams are in action midweek. Newcastle will be hosting Crystal Palace, while Leicester visit Everton in a game with potentially big ramifications down the bottom end of the table.
And the winner that Bruno Guimaraes scored against Leicester, I mean, that stuff of dreams, a diving header in the 95th minute at the Gallowgate end at St James's Park. There are strikers who've spent their entire careers at Newcastle and have never had a moment like that. And yeah, you know, once again, another great moment for the Newcastle fans who were in the absolute doldrums at the start of the season. And I think the fact that they've managed to turn things around to this extent in terms of their home games just shows how successfully, you know, Eddie Howe has managed to kind of detoxify the atmosphere there, albeit with, you know, the very unfortunate caveat that it's taken them being taken over by the Saudis for that to happen. And just a quick word on Bruno Guimaraes. He's now scored as many goals for Newcastle in 3 months as he did in 2 years for Lyon.
Crikey.
So he's obviously finding the air in the northeast to his liking.
This despite the fact that it's only really the last couple of games that he's been scoring in.
I think he's only played 5 matches, 5 league games for Newcastle, and he scored 3 goals. The first of which was that incredible volleyed back heel at Southampton, was it, a few weeks back? And he's, you know, he's not a goal scorer, despite the fact that he scored these fantastic goals. I don't think he's going to carry on scoring with this sort of regularity. It's not something we sort of saw from him at Lyon, but he is, you know, an extremely talented footballer, very well-rounded player. And I quite enjoyed the first goal as well. It's quite unusual to see the ball kind of get wedged between the goalie's legs and then be poked out by an opposition player. But it looks like, you know, the Newcastle fans have taken him to their hearts already. And with performances like that, you can see why.
Mm. All right.
I think the other slight thing to mention is Kasper Schmeichel seems to be going on one of those Hugo Lloris runs where commentators point out another very rare mistake by Schmeichel. And yeah, he's 35 now. And I wonder if he's the last one of those. I'm going to check that because that sounds really
35? That can't be right. He's still young Kasper.
That cannot be right.
Sure, he's younger than that.
Can't be.
Surely.
Right. Wow, listener, we're reeling.
35.
Probably your too.
35?
No way. When did that happen?
Mind's blown. I'm annoyed I double-checked it now, but yes, he is. He's 35. And I wonder if, you know, we know that Dean Henderson, for example, is going to be looking for a move this summer. We know Schmeichel is a huge presence in that dressing room. But I do just wonder maybe if this is the last remnants with Vardy of that title-winning team, because he is just making more and more mistakes, which when you're doing that at 25, no one really minds. When you're doing it at 35, your age, I think, suddenly becomes a factor. I mean, I'm sure he could play on till he's 40. It's just whether Leicester is starting and Rodgers is wondering whether maybe they'll look to buy a keeper this summer.
Daniel Storey, ending careers left, right and centre over here. Fernandinho, Kasper Schmeichel, it's over, guys. Yeah. It's over.
Pogba, bye.
I think they do mind when you're 25. How old's Zach Steffen, for example?
That, true.
Old enough to know better.
Well, yeah. Certainly is now. Anyway, there you go. That's our thoughts on the weekend. As mentioned, there is a pretty packed programme of midweek Premier League action from Liverpool, Man United on Tuesday all the way through to Burnley Saints on Thursday. A game that we won't be able to feature in Thursday morning's show, but all the other ones like Chelsea, Arsenal, Everton, Leicester, Man City, Brighton and Newcastle Palace, we will be talking about when Totally returns then. Before that, enjoy all our other podcast offerings. Have yourself a happy bank holiday if it still is one round your way. Many thanks to Tom, Daniel, Sasha, producer Charlie and you, listener. And we'll see you Thursday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.